Let's get started. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Nightmares Podcast, where we talk about all things horror, movies, television shows, art, and in this case, amazing music. We have, I believe this is his fourth time being on the podcast. I'm, of course, here with my partner, Zachary Smith. What's up?
What's up?
And we are here with Rob Benny. And just to keep the joke rolling, you, sir, can introduce your company.
How's it going, guys? Well, I'm great to be back, and I'm super stoked to be on the show, and it's great to catch up with you after such a long time. I know it seems like it's not a long time, but a lot of stuff's happened in the last couple of years, so it's been like a huge blur. But yeah, I'm just to give you all a heads up out there, if you don't know who I am or what I'm about, I have a music project called Cucurbitophobia. Cucurbitophobia is the fear of pumpkins, and the style of my music is pretty much horror-themed music. It covers a wide spectrum of styles and interjects everything from dark ambient to avant-garde to mood music to minimalist music to neoclassical to post-industrial and even some elements of metal. You know, I'm not saying that I am a metal project, but I do interject guitars at different points, and I do have some interesting influences from a lot of artists from the past and present that I interject to make for a, you know, just a really terrifying experience.
That's awesome. That's awesome, dude. And actually, yes, I think it's been about a year and a half since he's been on. Before the podcast, we were discussing all the crazy things that have happened in our personal lives. And actually, it was fun because I literally saw you on Mars, a website who we just a podcast we just had on from TBH Horror. She's out of Spain. If you haven't checked out that podcast with her, it was fucking awesome. I know Zach had a really good time with it as well. Yeah, dude. Just learning about like how horror is not really present in Spain, which shocked the hell out of Zach. He's like, I don't know that was a fucking thing.
Yeah, but it's I was talking about the same thing to her when I went on her podcast. She told me a lot of interesting stuff. You know, Spain's in a lot of ways, it's a very religious country. It's got a very Catholic stronghold, and a lot of them, you know, are very legitimately scared about films that deal with horror, especially films that deal with possessions or spiritual or demonic themes, which are completely forbidden and taboo in that culture, which, you know, for most of us Americans, you know, it's definitely foreign, you know, to us, because we're so desensitized with, you know, many movies over the years, you know, everything from movies like Rosemary's Baby to The Exorcist to The Omen to later films like Fright Night and Devil's Advocate, and even, you know, more current films, you know, films that don't even fit in that genre per se, but, you know, a lot of those films that have that, you know, paranormal, you know, demonic element. And those other places, they'd be either heavily censored or very heavily frowned upon to a point of being taboo to even talk about, much less watch.
Yeah. It's truly amazing how different other countries are when it comes to horror. Like, just the lack of a community is just so mind-blowing to me. It makes, like, just because I've experienced all this since I was 2 years old. So to think that people around the world just it's shocking, terrifying, scary, foreign, completely unknown to them is just bad. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, shit, okay. But it's just, when I first heard that, especially since we've been interviewing people around the world more recently, it's like, wow, that's interesting. I thought it was weird when friends of mine would get creeped out with somebody slitting their wrist on film. No, these people haven't seen anything, and it's because they're terrified of it. It's like, whoa!
And the passion, like, around being fucking terrified of it. Like, and when I asked her, I was like, well, they just like, okay, that's your thing, that's cool. Like, a lot of people in America, that's our normal response. Okay, that's cool, that's your thing, you know, whatever. It's like, not my thing, but like, that's cool. Like, no, they're like legitimately treated like a fucking plague. Like, they're like, get that the fuck away from me. It's
interesting. I mean, I don't know too much about, you know, too much of the deep history of certain European countries, but I do know that in many of those countries, there were even blasphemy laws that are like still on the books. So, I mean, some of these films would probably, you know, have certain people like arrested for, you know, violating their like religious doctrine, or like having them like sentenced to, you know, fines or jail time or something. For example, Ruggero Deodato, who recently passed away, who was an amazing director who did Cannibal Holocaust, he was brought up on charges, you know, for, you know, allegedly killing people, which he didn't do. which is a very just goes to show you how repressed a lot of these civilizations are, where you think that in this time of being in the 20th and 21st century, that people would have evolved and have become a little more thicker skinned. Not such is the case. It's definitely in some ways, you know, gone backwards.
But Rob, what a fucking hell of a compliment though, man. Like your horror movie was so realistic that you were brought up on murder charges.
That's how I heard about the movie.
That's what it is.
I mean, it's hilarious. Like, you know, like literally his defense literally was bringing the entire cast back. Be like, see, I didn't kill them.
Dude, I remember my cousin like begged me to pirate the movie because he was just like, dude, we got to see this movie. There's actual murder in it. I'm like, all right, well, shit. And I watched it and I'm like, okay, well, there's a few scenes where maybe, I don't know, did he actually kill any of the animals in the movie?
Well, yeah, that's the argument. Some of the animals did get killed. I mean, that bothered me a bit. And I think, but I also tell myself too, you know, and I'm not defending animal cruelty at all, but it's just in earlier times, it was much more of a common thing because they didn't have the special effects to create some of those, or they just wanted to make it as authentic as possible. But, you know, when it comes to animal cruelty, it sucks. I don't like to see it, but at the same time, it is what it is. Some people have done it, and you know, and that's just how it's going to be. Every person has the right to support it or not, whether it, you know, goes in accordance with their personal, you know, views or judgments. That's totally each to everyone's opinion.
No, 110%.
I will say there is an interesting law. I don't know how long it's been around, but apparently it is illegal to harm any sort of living creature on film, and it includes insects. You cannot squash a living insect on film. I don't know how long this law has been in effect, but I remember specifically because my cinematography teacher made such a big deal out of it. We're just like, shit, okay.
Dude, the goldfish.
Go ahead.
It's interesting because now we have these people in all of these different jurisdictions saying, oh, if you see lantern flies in your area, kill them immediately, you know, and now all of a sudden it's okay to kill insects. So it's like, where do you draw the line? Like, what's okay and what's not okay? You know, is it okay to kill a spider but not a lantern fly? I mean, where does it end?
Well, it becomes a ridiculous, you know, a ridiculous thing. I mean, we had a really interesting conversation in the last podcast about, like, you know, and this is like a far more extreme, but it was separating art from the person. You know, we were talking about the Jeepers Creepers controversy and everything else, but I still love Jeepers Creepers. And he's going to get his master's degree in literature, and they were having a debate about separating it. And my opinion on that was I thought it was ridiculous. Like, you know, I get it that, you know, but if you start doing that, then where's the line?
Absolutely.
You know, and like, you know, and like, the next thing is, oh, well, I don't want to talk about H.P. Lovecraft because, you know, he had racial stuff. I was like, he was in the 20s. Like he was a man of his time. And then it becomes a debate of, oh, well, I don't want to listen to that person because I disagree with them politically or culturally. Like, okay. Like, you know, where's the line? Like, where do you end this conversation?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, how it influences an individual's ideals and how it has an effect on their life. I mean, if you can be mature enough to separate the art from the creator, and in a way where the creator doesn't influence your ideals to a point where, you know, it breeds, you know, I would say poor behavior or bad manners or terrible social etiquette, then, you know, explore as much art as you want, as indecent or as disgusting or as depraved as it is. You know, if you live in a society that, you know, I guess I always seem to stutter at times, but in a society that, you know, stands for freedom of speech and freedom of expression, I think all freedom of expression should be there. And as the individual, you have the right to say, you know, that's disgusting or that's obscene. I'm not watching it. I want nothing to do with it. I will not support this. And you have the right to, you know, personally boycott anything that you don't agree with. But should it be banned? You know, should it be outlawed by the government? No. No, it's art. Yeah. Unless somebody was actually murdered or somebody was actually tortured in a way where it was done deliberately to harm someone, or if it was done to make, you know, a blatant political statement that, you know, poses a clear and present threat to, you know, a specific group of people or a society, then art should be as transgressive as it is and cross as many boundaries as it wants. And the viewer has the right to watch it or to disengage themselves from it.
Exactly. You know, and I was just going to say exactly what you just said. You know, they got these wonderful things on remotes. They're called buttons. You can press them and then go to something else. They have mouses on the internet where you can just go and click on. Oh, they have all these options and they can just go on to something else. They don't have to, like, you know, there is so much of a variety now. They have literally everything for every taste. Everything.
Absolutely. And if I feel like if you're going to be influenced by someone to do something stupid because of what you saw on a movie or read in a book or performed in a video game, then you're just personally weak. Then you have no, you know, ground to stand on, and you're the one who has to fix themselves, not the art or the game or the film or the music that they're engaging themselves in.
Exactly. And, you know, and this is what we talked about with Damon, you know, the creator of Slasher, just about how, you know, if you are influenced by art in a way that's going to be destructive, it was going to be something else anyway. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, it was only a matter of coincidence that it happened to be this thing. But, like, if it wasn't that thing, it would have been something else. Like, it doesn't really change, you know, and I think I speak for Zach on this as well. Like, you know,
don't speak for me.
Oh, fine, whatever. I thought you would agree with it, but fuck me anyways.
I can speak for myself.
Oh, shut up. we have fun here. Specifically horror is supposed to be, you know, cathartic, and it is cathartic for a lot of people. That's why I think the horror community are the nicest, kindest, most accepting people around. And I think that part of that reason, or probably all of that reason, is that we watch some of the most deplorable shit ever. And I guess
this will be the, I don't know, 20th something podcast we've been on now with the new format, and that'll be the 20th time you've said that.
It's because it's still true.
I'm just going to start keeping a tally marker every time Mark brings up that same speech.
And if I didn't write it in a fucking contract, he'd bring up A24 every 2 seconds and how much he hates it.
Shut up.
So, you can dish it out, but you can't take it, sir. Mm. I call bullshit.
Get on with your speech, damn it.
Anyway, like, I just think that like you exercise your fucking demons by watching fucked up shit. That's all. I mean, like,
yeah, sure,
of course, yeah. You're purging your anxiety. You're purging your anger. You're purging your sadness or your own apprehensions or your own personal fears. I mean, they could be deeper existential fears, such as, you know, what does the universe mean, or what's going to happen after I die, or does my life even have any purpose? I mean, horror movies sometimes don't necessarily answer those questions, but they allow us outlets to purge those and toy with our darkest fears and our, you know, rawest emotions. So after we watch it, we at least either could feel better, or we can reevaluate our stance or our current perspective on life and move forward from there.
And yeah, I couldn't have said it more poetically than that. So I was going to ask you too, you know, it says, holy shift gears. What's been going on with some of the new work you've been doing, man? Cause I've seen quite a few things pop up. We follow your social media. What have you been working on that's different in the last year and a half that we haven't really seen you?
October, September. You know, it's been a very vague, fuzzy couple of months. And I will just throw it out there. Last fall, I released Autumnal Apparitions, which is my latest album, Curbitophobia. And it's got 7 tracks on it. It's kind of a mini album, maybe a little longer than an EP, but it's still a shorter album. And it treads back into more ambient electronic territory. It has a more of a like very washy synth-based approach, and I draw heavy inspirations from 80s horror movies such as Fright Night and Life Force, and, you know, movies with a very like sci-fi feel where there's a lot of keyboards and a lot of like very washy parts. And I've also had some, like, you know, kind of Eastern influences throughout at certain points with some of the instrumentation I use, such as harps or certain percussive bongos that gave it a more of a ethnic fused type of environment to it. So it's definitely more of a chill, like laid back, lush kind of horror album, but there are still some atonal elements which are really jarring, like akin to what I've scored for you on A Stroll Through the Woods. So there's definitely some of those elements present.
which I loved. Did, when we were on when Rob was on last time, do we have episode 4 done, Zach? I can't.
Yes, remember. We did.
We did. Okay, cool. The I don't want to.
I had already bought the vinyl.
The
and it is fantastic.
It is fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
The you know, for those new people who are stopping by, Rob actually scored episode 4 of Living Nightmares: A Stroll Through the Woods, which was the easiest and yet best decision I think we've made on, in our company. Rob is a fantastic composer and music writer, and it was a very easy, you know, from what Zach told me, or at least from what I remember, it was an extremely easy process of just having a very simple conversation.
I thought composing was going to be a lot more complicated. It wasn't. It was way easier than I ever, well, at least for me. He actually composed it. I just told him what was needed. So,
well, first of all, thank you guys. I'm honored by what you've allowed me to help with the opportunity to do it. It's really, you know, been a great feather in my cap. It's given me, you know, some new experiences which have helped further my composition along with visuals, which has allowed me to expand my horizons and take, you know, input from external sources, which allows me to take a different perspective on putting music down, where if I were just doing things on my own, I really have no one else but my own thoughts in my mind telling me, oh, try this or do this instead. You know, having another person listen and, you know, evaluate to the point where if there's anything that needs to be modified or adjusted, you know, allowed me to, you know, think outside the box and push myself a little bit more into other directions. So I'd come up with something that fits the work, not only fitting to what I perceive, but what the creators like yourselves perceived with your short, which I think worked out fantastic.
I couldn't agree more.
I absolutely 100%. You know, when you were watching the footage, Rob, you know, what were some of the thoughts that inspired the actual score? I'm very curious to hear, you know, what your, you know, first thoughts were and kind of how you went and developed the actual score itself.
Well, when I saw like you like walking through the woods, like I saw the officer walking through the woods and throughout and just like searching the premise and then encountering individuals with masks in a very ritualistic approach, one by one approaching it, just that sense of dread sought in. It made me think, you know, what if it was one of us or anybody I know was out in the wilderness one night, the car breaks down, you know, you get out to change the tire or check the hood, and all of a sudden you see one by one a different individual with a different mask on, carrying a weapon or, you know, something to and with which to gag and bind you. At that point you're fucked. You know, where do you go? What do you do? I mean, there's nowhere to call for help because service is down. There's nowhere to go. You can't just walk to your local police station because you're out in the middle of nowhere. Literally, that sense of dread can set in, because that's a situation that can happen to literally any living being on the planet. I mean, unless you're a guru in mixed martial arts and you can take on 7 people at the same time, I mean, you know, you're probably gonna have to kiss your ass goodbye. And that's what sought in. I mean, or unless you are armed with a gun and are able to fight them off. I mean, but let's be serious. You know, how many of us, you know, especially in areas where guns are restricted, how many of us can, you know, realistically fend for ourselves in a situation where you're surrounded by a cult of people willing to, you know, use you for ritualistic sacrifice or for personal gain on their fucked up, depraved ends?
Yeah, you know, and you actually brought an even, you know, stronger light to it. I mean, you know, this is a cop, you know, and this is somebody who's trained to deal with these type of situations, not exactly these situations, but trained to deal with multiple suspects and trained to do that, you know, and I loved how you added in, like, well, what the fuck would I do? Somebody who isn't trained, who isn't armed, you know, just some normal guy who is, you know, who gets stuck on the side of the road or sees somebody flagging down, you know, it's a really interesting experience. And that's, I think that's what makes it so special. And you really nailed the escalation of it, you know, especially with some of the notes. Hey, you know, one note in particular I remember is you would get high on, I believe it was a keyboard, when Vinny came down from the tree and then the flashlight came on him and it was, and I was like, this is really, really fucking cool. You know, me watching, I almost forgot it was me. Because I was so enthralled with what was going on. And it wasn't me. You know, I wasn't focused on the cop. I was focused on the music and all the cultists as they were, you know, coming in. And obviously, you know, when Dennis comes in with the huge fucking mask and the axe, and you really, you brought a really interesting tension that went very well with the, you know, the one shot take. That really played into that. So it was really cool to see that escalation of the music.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that's what I was trying to go for. I was trying to go for, you know, a subtle yet effective approach. I wasn't trying to go all out. I wasn't trying to go in for the kill. I tried to leave it vague enough to, you know, allow the viewer to decide, you know, what's going to happen. And as, you know, as the scene, you know, transitions to when you were running out of the woods, you know, I tried to, you know, just play that along. So it was a smooth flow. It wasn't just like a sudden jarring sharp cutoff, but it wasn't like necessarily like an abrupt end either. It just slowly cascaded into a very ambient, like lonely, sort of eerie, ambient, atmospheric drone that just played out till the very end.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I love about it. It's an actual score, and that's the first time we've had a score in any of our videos. Hell, just shorts, you name it. I've always used stock music or I cannot for the life of me remember what the first com is, one of the places that we had access to in school. So I get a lot of my music from there. It's better than Audio Blocks. A lot of their stuff is pretty, you know, kind of just simple, generic, kind of by the books. But first com, they had a lot of good stuff up there. But you're making it work for your film. It's not made for your film. And that difference, mate, it was magnificent. It was fucking awesome.
You know what, too? And actually, Rob, I'm going to give you one last compliment a little bit just because I thought of it. The ending of it, when the narration is going on and everything else, was really, I think, where you got really, really good, because it was very subtle. And what I mean by that is like you just said, that those waving transitions of eeriness. And when I'm doing the narration and everything else, and then, you know, and the eeriness is kind of going up a little bit, and then the flashlight goes off, and then it goes right to the credits. It kind of had that same feel from the original Halloween, when the body's gone and they're showing the inner cuts. Those fuckers could be anywhere. They're gone. They could be fucking anywhere. And you gave it that feel. So when people left that, they went, holy shit, these fuckers are still in the woods. Like, they never found them. And it was kind of feel that you kind of had. And it was really, really cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's the point. You want to make it, you know, dwell in the viewer's mind, you know, 2 days from now, a week from now, a month from now. You want to make that dwell there and let them think about that and let them, you know, not be at ease. You know, sometimes they hear that creak in the door in the middle of the night. It'll allow them to think, you know, and while that scene unconsciously sets in their mind, it just builds upon that fear. And that's the beauty of horror all around, is that, you know, it's a great art that allows you to pray and play with your fears and really do it in such a deep level.
And also, too, the other creepy thing is that you also, not only could they be anywhere, they could be anybody. The running joke was that Vinny and Dennis stepped in as the extra cops, and I was like, wouldn't that be a twist if the cult members were actually the other two cops?
Yes, that would be. It's funny. Like, a lot of movies are like that, though, where they have like the people that you think are going to help you and be the saviors, and it turns out that they're in on the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, 110%. Like, yeah, I mean, obviously that was a running joke between all of us. That wasn't our intention. But it'd be fun to see if people watch that in the future and they go, wait a minute, those guys look familiar. I wonder, is that what happened? What's going on?
I think it's easier to spot out Vinny, but Dennis, because he has his hair, like, you know, done up, versus, like, the wild with the fucking antlers.
Yeah,
But I think, you know what, never mind, I forgot. He's a fucking giant. So, yeah, they're going to be like, that tall motherfucker looks familiar.
Yeah, he is the only tall motherfucker we could get to actually look imposing. But you rocked it, man. You know, I was gonna ask you too, because I didn't really get a chance to really talk to you about this. Have you done scores for other films, and if so, what was that process like for you?
Oh yeah, I one of my good friends, who was actually the best man at my wedding, he goes by NJ Movie Freak. He has his own podcast, NJ Movie Freak, on YouTube. And I've done, you know, some music for him, and I lent him music for his episodes. He just released the first episode of season 2 right on New Year's Day. It's an episode on Hellraiser, where I'm actually a guest on the show, and I did the music and lent him some Cucurbitophobia stuff for him. We talked about the entire Hellraiser franchise and, you know, how, like, each of the movies has evolved throughout the series. And we didn't touch too much on the remake or the reboot yet, but I feel like that needs its own episode, because I didn't have a chance to really fully examine and, you know, digest the remake just yet. Not because of bias, but just because I had so many movies on the list in queue that I've had to watch first before coming around to that.
Sure. the you know, and for sure. And then was there any other like you know, features or other shorts that you done as well, or was it kind of just those two and then that was it?
Well, I did stuff for when he did some theme park themed documentaries back in the 2010s. He had a series called East Coast Thrills 1 and East Coast Thrills 2, and I did the music for that. And I was still relatively new to scoring, but it allowed me to try some different styles of music. And he's working on another one in queue, which was supposed to come out in 2020, but it got sidelined because of the pandemic lockdowns. So he had to stop production on that for a while, but I'm not going to spoil it just now because it's still in the works. So, but it's in that similar vein. And I think it's just another step in that direction. But, I've done music for people off the record on like, I've done ghostwriting for several podcasts and, several like internet shows and, several, you know, videos, and I've done corporate ads for this housing community in Utah a long time ago, which did pay me some money. I also recently, at my wife's former job, you know, did a trailer for what she was doing based around Sound of Music's My Favorite Things as a advertisement where she sang and I played the music. That was another good gig too. So it allowed me to, you know, try some different styles. As far as horror goes, I think, you know, primarily, you know, A Stroll Through the Woods was the first thing that I did horror themed, you know, for an actual like a video, like a true film.
Nice, nice.
All right.
Yeah, nice. I'm glad that we were your first. We felt very special.
No, I'm honored. I mean, I'm really happy, and I truly enjoyed it. You know, just from the connection we made back at NJ Horror Con till now. I mean,
that was all the way in 2019. It's like, wow.
A lot of shit has happened in those years.
Yeah.
Dude, it's like, dude, where the hell did the time go?
It fucking went, that's for sure.
Dude, it disappeared like that. And it's interesting too is, if you did pursue other, you know, other works with everything, do you really like to, you know, kind of do your own thing, or do you like to work on scores for other people? You know, do you prefer one or the other? You know, obviously it's a shorter example, you know, a spread, but I'm curious about which one you like more, doing more your own music for your own reasons and then, or scoring for other people.
That's a very tough question, you know, and it's very hard to answer because I feel like it's a situation where you're comparing apples and oranges.
Okay.
You know, when you're doing your own thing, you're on your own time, and you're doing what's good for your own skills, and you're trying to, you know, go based on what you want to present to the world. When you're working for others, you also get to try new styles, and you get to realize that sometimes, you know, listening to other perspectives or doing things that are not necessarily in your wheelhouse might actually make you better as an all-around composer or an all-around musician. And I like taking chances and trying different things to allow myself to not just rest on my laurels or just, you know, be complacent with one thing at a time. So that's why I try to, you know, stay open-minded as possible to network and to, you know, take opportunities as they come, you know, and, you know, I try to, you know, narrow a scope to a certain degree, but at the same time, I don't cut myself off if it can do something that can help, you know, either, you know, make me money or allow me to, you know, get more exposure or gain new connections or make new fans and friends along the way.
Nice, nice. Okay, very, very cool. I love that. The you know, when Corey Poltergeist OD was on the because we had him on just as much. I think you guys are like the most reoccurring guests that we've had. I think he's up to three, and I think you're up to four now. Cool. You know, so which is awesome. We and that's a testament to how much we like you. To be perfectly that's honest, awesome. But the last podcast we were on, we kind of got a chance to go into process, because we never, you know, we talked about a lot of things in all the different podcasts. Obviously you did a Stephen King one, we just talked about that. You know, I'm very curious, you know, about your process as you develop new music, you know, or go back to the beginning, you know, when you first starting this. I'm curious about, you know, when it comes to certain melodies, you know, do you envision things in your head? Do you just start playing them on a piano? Do you play them on a guitar? You know, maybe give us, you know, us and the viewers a little bit more in-depth view on what your process is for creating music.
A lot of the processes are, spontaneous, but they do, like, it's controlled spontaneity. Like, for example, if I think of something in my mind to create, I'll sit down at the piano or the keyboard and I'll start playing a motif, and I'll start rehashing that motif and playing it over and over again. And if I decide I like it enough, I'll keep it and I'll build on it with another layer underneath it with the same sound, or try a different sound. Other times, if I hear another melody, I'll try it on, you know, the guitar, where I'll play a certain series of notes and will allow me to, you know, build upon those notes and expand from there. Other times, I think of a percussive rhythmic pattern in my head, where if I think of like a certain tribal sound, like a boom, 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 I'll use that and I'll just repeat that over and over until it's time to, you know, layer some music on top of it. And then once I have the music on top, then I'm able to build around it from there and just go as I go along. Other times, it's literally just, you know, make a long 7-minute piano free writing session, take out the best parts, place them in, and then re-record it, you know, with actual better technique, and have those better parts into a better sketch.
Nice, nice. So, you know, so it's a lot of trial by error. You know, you're going in there, especially when you do the free, you know, the free form, it's really you know, just going in there and saying, hey, you know, I'm going to pick the best spots that work.
Yes, and a lot of that free form is based on like what I'm like envisioning. You know, I could like tune out everything around, you know, and suspend my mind from reality for a moment and go into my, you know, inner place where, you know, I envision, you know, some of my darker thoughts and some of my, you know, deeper things that I've drawn from films or from books or from art and from music. And I just envision all of these swirling around that I just sort of channel out whatever comes out. And then I extract from there and then build upon the best elements that I extract and then either discard the rest or save them for another work down the road.
I think that's a real gift of an artist. Like, the difference between a lot of people is the ones that have imagination and then the ones who are able to get the imagination from the brain down to the fingers or down to, whatever medium they want to do, and finding a channel to express it. Like, that's the true, like, definition, because a lot of people have a lot of great imaginations, but they don't have a channel to, like, express them. And that's the real, right. You know, the real true test of an artist in so many cases is to get that shit out of you and onto something. They, you know, whether that's acting, film, you know, film creating, music, you know, so on and so forth.
Absolutely. You know, and it takes a degree of, like, courage in a way, too. Like, you have to, you know, tap yourself at your... when you're at your most vulnerable at times and use that and channel that into your art, you know, especially when it comes to horror, because a lot of horror is based around fear, suspense, mystery, or apprehension or uneasiness. Those are things that many of us aren't commonly, you know, drawn to. And when we experience them firsthand, we're not ready sometimes to deal with them, or we just don't know how to react. And putting that into an art form allows us to confront those in an artistic medium in a way that's not in a controlled environment or a sort of happy environment. In horror, we all know that the good guys don't always win, and sometimes who they portray as the good guys are not necessarily good to begin with. So, you know, it takes that element to a whole new level. Musically, I like to try to portray that in a sense where, you know, we're in like a casual, like a amoral kind of neutral world, and, you know, you're just on your own, just embellishing in this experience, and knowing what to do and where to go next is really up to you.
No, I love that. That's really cool. You know, I got a question I'm going to keep in the back of my pocket, but this is something interesting. This is more for like Zach and you, because I kind of want to hear your both perspectives. You have a composer, you have a director here. You know, what's the relationship in your guys' eyes, and maybe just through the lens of horror, cause we'll keep it simple. The relationship of film and music, specifically like scores and soundtracks and things like that, not so much like sound effects and all that stuff, but like the relationship of what music does for horror film, what does horror music do for horror films, and what does horror films do for horror music? How does this relationship, you know, go so well together? You know, it was just some idea that I had in my head, and I kind of want to hear both of your perspectives on it.
Well, do you want to go first, Zach?
So I'm not really sure how to word this, but I would say it's a very symbiotic relationship, I guess. A lot of my favorite songs, because I listen to scores all the time. Doom's Carter and Took, Dead by Daylight, the Dead by Daylight theme song, where it has the name in the, I don't know if it's the melody or whatnot, the Terminator theme, the Jaws theme. Yes. I listen to all these, these are in the realm of horror, and I love it. And it's like one cannot exist without the other, and it just boosts it up, and it's this very symbiotic relationship, and I fucking love it. If you have a great score with a great film, it's like magic. I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah.
I absolutely think it's necessary. Well, maybe not necessary, but it definitely helps elevate the piece.
Absolutely.
That's really how I would word it, I guess, in my
that's
weird brain.
That's perfectly said. You said it best, Zach. That's a great way to put it. I mean, both go hand in hand with each other. It's almost like a 50-50 sort of connection, because when you have visuals that are stunning and, you know, ready to capture you, you need something else to complement that and to add to it. I mean, if you're just to watch, you know, a horror movie with no music at all and it's just complete silence, it's literally just like watching reality. And, you know, it seems brutal and blunt, but it doesn't seem as scary as once you add the dissonant atonal horrifying sounds of, you know, shrill strings or, you know, insane intense bursts of guitars or clashing percussions, tribal bongos, at that point where it all just flows together and it's this one chaotic ball that's just is ready to charge at you. And, you know, visually, you know, if you were to like take music on its own and add something to that, it allows the viewer to have a more precise viewing of what the music is trying to prescribe or describe.
Yeah,
or portray.
I absolutely agree, and I'm even going to give an example. So, in the game, this isn't a horror video game, and it's not a movie. It's a video game. In the game Far Cry 3, I very much enjoyed the game. There's one specific level where I don't think you're supposed to enter this level normally, but I came in on a hang glider, parachuted in, and what you're supposed to do is take this flamethrower and burn an entire field of weed. All right, and the song comes on. I never would listen to a song like this, but it's like a Bob Marley Skrillex mix called Make It Burn Them or something like that. And that song with that level was so perfect. It's just nice. This weird. I think it's technically techno EDM. I don't know the proper term for the song. All I know is that song and that level were so fun that I was just like, yeah! So nice. Fun! So cool. Epic! I'm like, yeah!
You know, you kind of touched on something interesting. The, you know, Rob, you're kind of going into it, but I really wanted to go deeper in it, which was, you know, you said it, you both said it was a 50-50 relationship, but, you know, can you still enjoy horror music without the film? But I don't know if you can do the reverse. I don't know if you can enjoy the film necessarily without the music. And when I'm in, like, perfect example, two perfect examples, Halloween and Jaws. They, I can enjoy the theme song to, you know, the score to Jaws and the score to Halloween all by itself. But if I were to watch the movies without those scores, I think they would be very flat. Like the movies itself would be very, very flat, you know, especially Jaws. I mean, like John Williams, you know, made that fucking shark, because you don't see it, you know, 75% of the goddamn movie. So, you know, I mean, it's very Hitchcockian and it works great. But I'm just curious on that fact of like, I can enjoy a piece of music, but I don't know if I can enjoy a film as much without the score. So I don't know if it's 50-50 necessarily, but I wanted to get both of your perspectives on that in the same vein of this conversation.
You want to go first, Rob? Or
sure. Yeah, okay. I guess in the traditional filming framework, you know, where it's a, you know, from a beginning to end plot, you know, with a narrative and, you know, a fictional story, that I guess it's 50-50, but I mean, if you're going into the realm of found footage film, such as VHS, for example, which, you know, doesn't have a score, you know, which they're just kind of like free flowing and they'll have musical snippets at different points, but it's not part of the actual film. Some of those films do have some disturbing, violent imagery and some really genuinely shocking scenes, which did scare me. And out of all the found footage movies I've watched, the VHS franchise has been one of my favorites that I've seen. You know, I've even seen the most recent one, which, you know, I enjoyed for what it was, but I still think the first VHS film was the best in the whole series, in my opinion. That being said, what do you think, Zach?
So I still think it's 50-50. I know I've seen scenarios in both movies and games where there's no music and the scene can be terrifying. Now, Mark, with your examples, I mean, those we've seen those scenes with the score already intact. If we were to see those two separate, like, all right, you hear the Jaws theme without seeing the movie, it's not going to mean nearly as much. You see the Jaws movie without the score, I think it still might be effective, but it's not going to be as effective. You add the two together, and it's magic. It's literal magic.
So, and that's a good point, actually. Just you just said
That is
that,
a very good point.
And, you know, and I think that maybe I enjoy the score. I mean, the score of Jaws is fantastic, but say for instance, if my memory was just gone, you know, and everything else, I had never seen the movie, you know, it would be an amazing score, but maybe it wouldn't have the impact that that it does because I've seen it with the movie and the score together, that the score, you know, wouldn't be it. So maybe there's something to be said about that, you know, like you said, you know, music is film brings context to music. And maybe, you know,
Yes.
even you have a great piece of music, but it doesn't have the same effect. It's kind of like how certain songs are used in movies. You know, like
Yes,
Hip to Be
yes.
Square will always be American Psycho to me. Like it's
Yes,
changed.
absolutely.
And by the way, I'm a massive Huey Lewis fan. Massive.
Oh, me too.
But I also, though, I did become a massive Huey Lewis and the News fan because of Back to the Future. They
There
so
you go.
and then also too is you know, the funny thing is, this is a very off the wall example. Always loved Metallica and still love it. Battery is still one of my favorite songs. But there's a movie called Project X. It's a found footage movie where they it's about a big party. They literally burn the fucking house down while Metallica's Battery plays in the background. And now it's forever stuck in my fucking head. So
That's amazing.
it's crazy how pieces of music get attached to film. Like, you know, something can mean something to you, and then all of a sudden, like, it's like I Put Fine on it, for us. Like, you know, you
Yes.
know, it's you know, and now it's Fuck the Police in that context, you know.
Or Don't Stop Believing with The Sopranos by Journey.
Yeah, that's also
That's,
another great
yep.
example. The
I was gonna say the biggest one now. A whole generation of people are gonna associate Metallica with Stranger Things.
Yes, absolutely. And
Yep, that's
you
gonna
know,
be the big one.
yep, and you know what? And of course, I feel really messed up for saying this, but I've never seen Stranger Things yet. I've just never gotten around to it.
Neither have I.
I've wanted to check it out of curiosity, but I've just never had the chance to. I just sometimes I always hear everyone asking me about the show, and it's not that I dislike it. It's just that I just haven't gotten around to it. There's been so many other movies on the list that I've gotten around to. I mean, I just recently watched Terrifier 2, which I thought was gory as hell, and you know, for a modern day film, it was one of the better modern horror films that I've seen. You know that. You know, recalled like the Friday the 13th days or the Nightmare on Elm Street days, where it had that, you know, fun slasher element, but it also had like the, you know, the very like deeper like elements of gore that I haven't seen since movies like Maniac, you know, like which
Wow.
was, you know, the original Maniac. I mean, it had a lot of blood. I mean, for, you know, a big budget like movie, you know, I mean, I think it disturbed me just as much as when I watched the first Saw movie, you know, but in a lot of ways it was really good. But, you know, there's other things like Stranger Things, which just become popular, and I'm not interested in them because I just don't really, if something doesn't grab me about it, and I'm always more drawn to the actual macabre shows rather than the shows that flirt with horror but don't really go deep into it.
Yeah, no, that's true. The go ahead.
I'll say this about Stranger Things. I very much enjoyed the first two seasons. I thought they were really good. Three was a bit of a slog, and four was better. And I don't give a fuck what anybody says. That scene, the whole Eddie Munson scene was very, very overhyped. I've seen much better scenes with epic guitar riffs. I have played Brutal Legend and I have played Devil May Cry 3. Those outdo that scene by fucking miles.
Yeah.
Cool scene, not as great as it should have been. That's all.
Or imagine a song like Dragon Force Through the Fire and the Flames or something like
Oh.
or anything by Rhapsody of Fire or Blind Guardian, like any like power metal band from Europe can like that can run circles around Master of Puppets. No disrespect to early Metallica because the first three albums are pure gold. But I mean, some of the European bands like Blind Guardian, some of the thrash they put out in the '80s was like fucking amazing. You know, even the newer stuff they've done is really good, but the earlier shit like Follow the Blind or Somewhere Far Beyond, great albums, you know, with excellent thrash riffs and solos that just are tasteful but yet just rip.
Quick question. When did Dragon Force get started?
I think in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay. I was like, were they around in the 80s? Okay.
Yeah, the
They were around for a while. They weren't really as popular. They had a couple of albums then, but then I think they broke in 2006 with Inhuman Rampage, which had Through the Fire and the Flames. And it's a pretty good album. It's a solid power metal album. I mean, it wasn't my favorite compared to, you know, bands like Rhapsody of Fire or Blind Guardian, which I've, you know, long before enjoyed and explored in the 90s before I got deeper into metal. But you know, Dragon Force, they're good for what they are, and I'm glad they're still around and kicking, you know, with a new singer and, you know, still putting out albums and touring and doing what they love.
Yeah, they are. I'm sad because like literally the day before Chicago went into lockdown, I was going to go see them at the House of Blues, and then we get the email and the whole city. I'm like, you couldn't wait one fucking day.
That sucks. That really sucks.
Sad.
Yeah, that
sucks.
He messaged me about it. He was really pissed. By the way, I just thought of another one too. The Gremlins 2, Angel of Deaths by Slayer. When the fucking gremlin turns into the spider gremlin, I have sold people on that scene alone. And I was like, that's all you need to know. That's it. Like, I don't know what else. I don't know why you're not. You should leave right now and go watch that movie. I don't know what else you need to know.
What's really funny is I first heard Angel of Death when I was like 12 years old. Like, you know, when I was like 12 going on 13. And when I first heard that and I picked up Rain and Blood on CD at that time at the tender age of 13, I thought that whole album, that would like be a perfect like soundtrack for a horror movie. Like, that had a lot of horror elements throughout, you know, with the title track, with the Angel of Death, Altar of Sacrifice, Criminally Insane. I mean, just that album has such a dark, scary element, you know, underlying throughout, that I was like, at the time when I first put that on, I'm like, this blows Metallica and Megadeth out of the water. I'm like, how did I not know about this? And I was like, this is amazing.
Slayer in 2019 will forever be the best concert I have ever seen. And I'm genuinely surprised not many movies have actually used their music. It is honestly mind-blowing.
Yeah, especially, it really is.
No one has done a scene with Raining Blood with Rain and Blood.
Yeah, I know. That would be amazing. I'll give you one. Spill the Blood, the final track on South of Heaven. That intro is the creepiest shit I've ever heard. I used to have nightmares with that song when I was like a teenager. And like cool nightmares, though, where you see like glowing skulls on the wall, like with like red eyes. And like, I think about that song. And I mean, like, that would be perfect. And then that riff kicks in. It's just, that's creepy stuff. And that's the stuff that I've always been attracted to.
Yeah, it's one of these days I want to do, like, if I ever... I don't know what movie I want to do it to, but I want to take Delusions of Savior and Repentless and put it to the intro of one of my movies. Nice. Especially Delusions of Savior, because at the intro of their performance, they were playing it and they had the cross turning upside, and I'm like, yeah!
That's amazing.
That's awesome.
And what the hell did we get with them? We got fucking Gremlins 2, and we got like a couple of songs in Dracula 2000. That was it. God Hates Us All album.
It was right around the God Hates Us All album. Came out like the movie came out first, and then the album dropped a year later, I think, in 2001. I'm a little bit fuzzy with the time period. It was very close by, but the movie had great graphics, but the plot sucked, in my opinion.
I thought it was fun and hilarious, and it's even better when you realize that Dracula was Gerard Butler. I'm like, wait, Leonidas? I mean, like,
the imagery, though, was cool. Like, I liked I liked the scene. Like, the visuals were stunning. And, like, that was, like, the cinematography itself was really cool.
I liked the addition. I liked the twist. I did like the twist. I liked it was an expansion on the lore that had never been done before. And I appreciated the change in the direction. You remember, Zach, you remember what the twist was?
What was it? His daughter or something?
No. He's Dracula's Judas. I thought that was a cool twist on the mythology because it had never been done, and it actually makes sense.
It was an interesting twist.
Yeah. But it's just so fun to think about like how many of these songs are directly related to that, and also too is it's the movies that make you give a shit. Would you even know what the fuck is going on with the Psycho score? You have no idea. You have no idea what the hell. I mean, it's kind of cool, but like, you would never understand the impact of it. Without it. I mean, and there's just some songs that are just going to be forever connected to some great fucking movies.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite movies, and I try to talk about this as much as I can because it's one of my favorites, but I feel like it doesn't get talked about enough, is The Exorcist 3. The Exorcist 3, it came out in 1990. That is a fucking amazing art film right there. That, in my opinion, is better than the first Exorcist film because the cinematography, the music score behind that, and just the way the suspense builds up throughout is mind-blowing. And I've watched the first Exorcist maybe twice, and it gave me a hard time getting through because I got bored throughout a few times. But The Exorcist 3, I've watched it about a half a dozen times, and every single time I watch it, I just never get sick of it. It's just so well done and so well put together. And the director's cut is
one of these amazing. I gotta watch it one of these days. I've seen the first two. I've seen the first one plenty of times. I still find it hilarious that everybody found that to be the scariest movie of all time. But like my mother was terrified. Like when she finally, because that was she took a little while to show me Jaws because of the whole shark thing. She refused to show me that one for so many years. I was a teenager when we finally watched it. It was me, my buddy Justin, and my grandfather. My grandfather fell asleep. My buddy Justin got scared and ran off. Well, actually, I don't know. He had his suspicions about the movie, and he walked off to go watch that 70s show. And I'm just sitting here laughing at the absurdity of the whole movie. Girl crab walking down the stairs, stabbing herself in the vagina, saying "fuck." I'm like, what the fuck?
Your mother sucks cocks in hell.
This is just hilarious. It's so absurd. It is amazing.
Do you understand, man? Like, okay, so Rob will back me up on this. Like, no one had ever seen anything like that. No one had ever seen anything like that. People were like, what? I remember my Nana told me about going to see it. They saw it at an earlier showing, and it was hilarious. They actually, as they were walking out, and they were talking about it, like, it was pretty intense. They saw an older couple that were probably in their 70s or 80s going in to go see it, and they're like, oh, fuck. Somebody call an ambulance. They're going to fucking have a heart attack in the damn theater.
I'll tell you, one of the funniest things was a friend of my mother's told me back in the 90s, she was complaining, like, when I was a teenager, she's like, don't ever see that movie, The Devil's Advocate. I went to the theaters and I saw it, and I walked out. Like, that is a sick, disgusting movie. I've watched it, on my own years later. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a masterpiece. I think it's one of the most underrated movies, especially since Al Pacino played an amazing role as Milton, and Keanu Reeves did an amazing job in his role too. Charlize Theron, she did a wonderful job as well. Everybody was well placed in that movie, well acted, and it's disturbing that it never got the critical acclaim and the box office success that I feel like it should have.
Yeah, no, it's probably one of Keanu's best stories. I mean, Zach knows this story, but like, just the cultural impact of The Exorcist for a second. The my dear family friend, who's my uncle essentially, Uncle Tommy, he went to go see the movie. And I have a very Italian background. Everybody in the neighborhood was Italian, so they would have the ladies in the neighborhood would get together, and they would actually have a statue of the Virgin Mary delivered to people's houses, and they would rotate, and it's like a church group thing. And then they would do prayers. All very, very Catholic. They would do prayers. Have a prayer group, and then they would go have coffee and cake and whatever, and then kind of hang out. And the Virgin Mary would stay in someone's house for an entire week. And the party had been over for several hours, and she was waiting for Tommy to get home. And all the ladies were still there. And she was like, I wonder where Tommy is. He's awful late and everything else. And all of a sudden, he comes in through the back door, and he has a 10,000-mile stare. He's like staring like off, and I'm like, how was the movie, Tommy? He doesn't even acknowledge them. He just looks in the living room, and he sees the statue of Mary, and he's like, How long is that going to be here for? And they're like another week. He's like, good, I'm sleeping under it for the whole fucking week. And Lily left. He walked out. He grabbed all his shit and then went into the living room, set up his bed, and then went to bed. It's so funny. Like, and too, and by the way, this is even funnier because he's the guy like that, you know, like in your friend group or like your family group. He's the guy that no one has a bad thing to say about it. He's like the nicest guy, and it's just so. It's even funnier to see him in this type of situation where he was so fucking scared. He's like, "Fuck this! I'm sleeping under a Virgin Mary for an entire week," and he did. He did the entire week. He slept under it until finally they had to let it go, and then he felt comfortable. Hell, my Nana didn't shower for a fucking month after Psycho. She had to have her dad like hang out in the general vicinity because she was so scared of taking a shower by herself because of that movie. It's crazy, like the cultural impact of horror movies and what they do on people's psyches.
Oh, dude. Yeah. I will admit that when I first saw Saw, the very first Saw in 2005, when I first watched it, I was watching it on DVD, I got to admit, it gave me anxiety for a while. That movie was very anxiety-inducing, especially the scenes where the pig mask would jump out of the closet, you know, things of that nature. You know, there's just the jump scares and just the story itself was very unsettling. And then when I saw Saw 2, I was even more messed up for like a week or so. But then I started to really become desensitized and realize that, you know, these films, as scary and as disgusting as they are, some of the stuff that happened in the Saw movies is pretty far-fetched. I mean, it's very rare that all these traps would be executed perfectly at the time they would be. And a mastermind as such would have probably been caught in the act a lot earlier, you know, especially if he was trying to go as elaborate as he was with some of the devices that he was using to build the traps.
And also, too, it has to account that these people are fucking morons.
Yes, that too.
Like, these are the people that like star in infomercials. Like, they're not the smartest people. They are
complete dummies. It's like when you watch somebody's movies and you see so many people get killed and you realize, like, no, yeah, you're a moron. Like, you're an asshole. Like, what are you doing in the woods at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, by yourself or with a couple of your buddies going, oh, let's get drunk and let's just go randomly walk in the forest and nothing's going to happen. Oh, let's go from this random house somewhere. Or, you know, someone just walking at someone and just going, hey, why do you have that stupid mask on? Let me touch it. I mean, all of those instances are – you're just asking for trouble. I mean, at that point, I have no sympathy.
The only one I forgive is the boyfriend that goes out to the woods to go bone his girlfriend. Because that's the thing with dudes. We only have enough blood supply to allow one or the other to function at 100% efficiency. Like, let's be perfectly honest. Nobody's thinking correctly at that point. They're just horny and they want to get their bones off. So no one's thinking in the right mind.
College people that are like sexually starved. I mean, that's what it's showing. It's just showing the fact that, you know, these people that have these impulses, they don't think straight, and that they're at the point where they'll let anything happen and they'll take any risks, whether it's walking through the forest or going swimming in some lake naked, you know, where there's no one around, you know, waiting for their lover to show up there, you know, like in Friday the 13th part 2, for example, like that scene by the water. I mean, you just think about that and it's like, it just goes to show you how, you know, sexually starved some of these the characters are in the movies and stuff. And it's like, no, there's a masked fucking killer out there. What are you doing? Get the fuck out of there and go back inside. Like, I mean, in your rational mind, you're thinking that, but when you're like watching it, when you're first watching it as a child, you're like, he's coming. Like, you feel bad for them. When you get older, you're like, fuck you. Like, go Jason.
You're a moron. Like, well, you know what? It goes to show how everybody makes bad decisions when they're really horny or drunk or both.
Or stoned, or whatever.
If you want to know who would survive a horror movie and who wouldn't survive a horror movie, let them play one of the horror video games that are out there, because my survival rate heavily outweighs my death rate. Like, when me and my buddy, like when Friday the 13th, the game came out, I was so excited and hyped to play that game. And I fucking loved it. To this day, my favorite asymmetrical horror game. Me and my buddy survived, I would say, 99% of the games we played, because we play like smart people. We would be stealthy. We would stick together. We would work as a team while everybody else is like fiddling around, acting like idiots, walking around, waving their flashlights, but fucking up the repairs and shit like that. We're like, you dumb fuck. Or even Dead by Daylight. The amount of people that can't get a goddamn button prompt right is mind-blowing. I'm over here just like, I'll wait for them to and they're gone. Okay.
And And they're dead.
I'm just gonna bye.
It's so fucking funny. Like it's like that joke in like Cabin in the Woods and everything else, where like he's like, we should all stick together. And then the pheromones come in. He's like, no, this is stupid. We should split up. And the stoner's in the back like, how is that a good idea? I love satire. It's so fucking great.
You don't realize how much satire is in a lot of slasher films, you know, even with the Terrifier movies. I feel like anything with Art the Clown is just amazing. I think he's like an anti-hero in my opinion.
I love it. It's crazy too, when it comes to, horror scores and everything else, we're talking about like cultural influence. What do you think have been some of the biggest cultural influenced scores? And maybe we'll even expand outside of horror, but for the sake of this podcast and this conversation, I'm curious to hear what your opinion is on that.
As far as like influences on my own style in general, or just in horror in general?
How about both?
Well, in horror, I mean, I know a lot of classical music and a lot of jazz music, a lot of like atonal world music that's foreign to American culture. A lot of that's been intertwined in American horror and even world horror too. I mean, you think about dissonant tones, like think of in music theory the tritone, which is like that has been known as Diabolus in Musica, like the Slayer album title, Devils in Music. A lot of for a long time, composers were forbidden or very heavily discouraged to use that tone in their music because it created such a dissonant sound. A lot of composers in the 1800s, 1900s, and the 20th century have started to break those boundaries and started to interject them into their compositions. Igor Stravinsky, for example, Russian composer, he used his sounds in The Rite of Spring, which was about a pagan cult which forces a young girl to sacrifice herself to the gods of spring by dancing herself to death. And that film score has influenced that composition has influenced film scores like Jaws and like some of the scarier parts of Jurassic Park and Star Wars, some of the very like dissonant sections of that, which come across as very grotesque. Another is a composer, Arnold Schoenberg, who is an Austrian composer who, used a 12-tone system, which was very deep, very dissonant, very dark, and yet very like a eerie at times. And some of those elements have, spilled over. Composers like Charles Ives have used like compositional clashing where they would like, he would take like elements from like one side doing one tempo and then another side like completely clashing with a different tempo. So it would just be totally noisy and chaotic. Mm. Check out Three Places in New England or the Robert Browning Overture, for examples, is that. Other composers like John Cage have completely broke the boundaries and have done, incorporated styles of music from other cultures, like Asian music and Eastern music, in a way that was, out of the box. So horror composers, I think, have used a lot of those similarities from different composers since, Nosferatu came out in the early 20th century, and when Frankenstein and Dracula and a lot of the other 30s films came around, a lot of these composers just used those suspenseful tonal motifs that these composers used from the earlier days and have, allowed them to seep in and, use them in a very like dramatic and chilling way. There are many, many other composers who I haven't mentioned that have had a dramatic influence on, modern horror scores, but to list them all would probably take me hours. I'm sure there's a lot of glaring omissions we haven't spoken about, but a lot of people can do their research and just kind of trace back to the earlier roots of horror by, watching the early suspense mystery films and horror of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and so on, and to see, how the music has evolved throughout the years. Nice. I do think that Bernard Herrmann, the composer of Psycho, he was brilliant in what he did with the score, just using two notes, the minor second, and then interjecting under lower, and then doing a lower note, and then just building on that, like almost like a pyramid, starting at the top and then expanding and expanding until just one big boom at the end.
Wow, that's really fucking cool, actually. I didn't even think about it from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, and then think about like one of my favorites is Halloween. From John Carpenter. I mean, just going from dun, 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 that's the most popular part of it. But then the other part towards the end, just dun, 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 dun,
yeah,
dun, dun. That just, over time just really seeps in. Another score I really talk about from an underrated film, the original When a Stranger Calls from the 1970s.
Yeah,
the opening,
sure.
The opening sequence, that opening sequence is fucking amazing. And have right after that music comes in, after the voice goes, "Have you checked the children?" That like gave me the fucking chills. It still gives me the chills every time I've seen that scene. Those are just a very, very few small examples, but
that's really fucking cool. And you know, and Tana, to expand on that, you know, because you went into really cool detail, and I loved it. But you know, when it comes to these scores, you know, how do you think that they've kind of, you know, seeped into the culture? You know, because obviously everybody parodies Jaws, and like everybody knows those fucking notes, and everybody you can walk into a swimming pool and hear somebody fucking around and you know and mimicking the theme. You know, so I'm curious, you know, you being the music expert, how have you seen how a lot of these scores have kind of infiltrated culture? And you know, like, you know, with Psycho and you know that high pitch, it's been parried dozens of times. So I'm curious how you've seen a lot of these scores that you have, that you know so much about, kind of infiltrate culture and really affect it in a certain way.
Well, I mean, they've infiltrated, like you said, comedy movies. You know, you can go back to movies like National Lampoon's Vacation, the first one with Chevy Chase, when the shower scene happens, when he walks in with the banana, it's like, and he opens up and he's just going, and it's just really ridiculous. And you're just like, oh man, with a banana. And then you look at like Wayne's World, like when Garth is like really pissed at Wayne, he's just stabbing the voodoo doll going, like just things like that, you know, it's just so stupid. And like, but it's so funny, like it's stupid funny. And I love that kind of humor because it just goes to show you how it is. Or you think of like all the parodies that you hear from people trying to mimic Jason going, like you hear that a lot, or you see people sneak up around you. You look around Halloween and you see people making those noises going, and you see people get like either jump scared or like, you know, nervous about it. Or, you know, and this, I think the most common one that's misattributed is a lot of people think of Hannibal Lecter and they go, "Hello, Clarice," but he never really says that line in the movie.
Yeah,
which
that's
is
true.
Even funnier.
That is true. The no, it's so true. And then also too, people fuck up. You know, Luke, I am your father. You know, they, like,
yes,
never fucking said that. Just said I'm your father. It's like, yep. No, I am your father. Like, no, that's it. I've watched the scene a couple times.
Only a couple.
Yeah.
Wimp.
No, a lot. That was me being.
No,
very,
Mark, you said a couple.
That was me being very.
Can you even
sick
call yourself a fan?
I am. Anyway, moving on.
Name the sound of the lightsaber.
Really?
No, I legit have the first six movies memorized by the lightsaber sound. So my buddy Adam, he was watching
awesome.
Episode 3 in the background, and I'm just like, hey, Anakin and Obi-Wan are swinging down the hallway now. They clashed. Anakin just did his little twirl, and he's watching. Look, he's like, how the hell do you know that? I can hear the lightsaber sounds, dude. How do you know these? Like, he's like, Jesus Christ.
Because I'm obsessed. That's the reason why.
I really am.
I will say another one, though, is, I mean, it's not necessarily horror. I'd say it's more like on the blurs and lines of sci-fi and horror, but the Twilight Zone theme.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's been seeped in a million times. You'd see so many movies, comedy, drama, or even TV shows where someone would just out of nowhere go, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and it would just be like, you'd instantly know that it's from a Twilight Zone.
It's almost become at this point like, you know, the same way people quote movie lines, they quote scores. If they're that, you know, like that's the real test of something iconic is if people can quote them the same way, you know, mimic them the same way that they quote movie lines. I mean, that's the true test. I mean, you know, and like Terminator's no different. Like that's another one. And I think that really comes down to is your melody, you know, at its basic form? Is it stripped? Is it something that's very tangible and easy? And I think that in my mind, the most famous scores, and obviously I'm excluding some of them, but the most famous scores and famous themes are so simple, but yet
so
complicated, but they're so complicated that they're simple, or so simple that they're complicated. When they're so easy, you know, like you can do the first two notes of something the same way that like Elton John knew that Benny and the Jets was going to be,
yes,
you know, bum. And then everybody knows what the fuck, you know, what the fuck's going on. Like, you know, the so it's so ingenious to hear, you know, like, you know, dun, 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 dun. Like, I don't know what the fuck that is. Like, it takes all of 2 seconds.
Dude, if you listen closely to the Battlefield theme, you can hear the Terminator theme in that. Like, I remember when I first heard the I'm like, huh? Wait, hold up. Wait, I know where that's from. You did a good job with it, but still, you're not fooling anybody.
Or when you watch the opening to Reanimator and you're like, I don't know, that sounds very very similar.
Yeah.
He burrowed.
I will say that the movie H.P. Lovecraft Reanimator, I think the theme of that definitely paid homage just to the Psycho theme. There were so many similarities. That was, in my mind, I could have been a blatant ripoff. And I heard it, I'm like, wait a minute. Like, some of those themes are so similar, but they're twisted. And I know where they made them change to avoid possible lawsuit. But yeah, that was definitely, you know, a blatant homage, to put it mildly, or, you know, a light ripoff, to say, you know, as it were.
I still loved it. I thought it was great. I was just like, you know what? I know what it is, but it fucking works.
Oh yeah, it absolutely works. The you know,
fantastic movie.
The you know, and I imagine too, that's, you know, is it, you know, that's a goal of a lot of composers, you know, especially in some of these more, you know, popcorn flicks, you know, action horror, you know, something that's very epic, is to have something that that's easily recognizable. The you know, when you're going in, and not so much in the, you know, original music, but like something that's, you know, in, when you're creating a theme, just something very, very simple, something that people will remember forever.
Oh, of course. Simplicity and subtlety say a lot more than just trying to throw everything in the kitchen sink into it at once. I mean, you know, at a certain point, when something becomes too pretentious or full of itself, it sometimes works against the creator, or works against the director or the filmmaker or the musician trying to, you know, make such a bold statement. I think the boldest statements are the ones, as if you said, are the ones that didn't require, you know, a million bells and whistles, but, you know, said a lot with less.
No, I absolutely love that. The it's so cool to have that type of, you know, cultural impact, you know, from that perspective. So the hey, you know, I wanted to, you know, like so tell us a little bit about this new album, the a little bit more into like the process. I know you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but like, you know, what's got you, you know, really excited about it? You know, what's different from some of the previous music that you've put out?
Well, with Autumnal Apparitions, which, if you haven't seen it before, this is the cover. It's got a cool red cover. I took this up in the Hudson Valley of New York State, which is not too far from Sleepy Hollow, which is the grounds for the legendary Headless Horseman. And while I designed it in an abstract way and manipulated the graphic, I wanted to go for an album that encaptured the autumn themes, you know, not necessarily just with Halloween, but just with autumn in general, with the falling of the leaves, the impending winter that represents death and, you know, the cycle of life, you know, restarting over again from winter through the rest of the seasons. I feel like autumn is just that stark reminder that, you know, it's, things are about to change, you know. Like, as we discussed Samhain in one of our earlier episodes, Samhain was the Gaelic festival, which, you know, where people would, you know, prepare their harvest because they knew that the end was coming, and that would be a celebration and an homage to, you know, the impending winter that would, you know, come. So, I mean, like, once the winter solstice comes, it's a celebration of, at that point, a celebration of life, you know, in spite of the death that, you know, comes about with the change of seasons. But with this album, I wanted to go for the autumnal feel. So each track I, you know, composed, I tried to think of, like, you know, things that you associate with autumn, with Halloween. You know, The Cloak of Twilight is my first track, and I tried to go for 80s vampire movie themes with that sound. So I was trying to go for, like, a sound which, you know, captured, like, the Lost Boys type essence, or Near Dark, or Fright Night, or tried to have that spooky eeriness as if a vampire's dwelling down on the window, you know, just peering through the screen. I have another track number two, which is called November Woodlands, which I wanted to just encapture as, like, a very, like, rustic, sullen November scenery type feel, which goes very ambient with a light harp and a piano sound. I have The Ritual by the Creek, which is the definite homage to A Stroll Through the Woods and, you know similar cult type movies that take place out there. And I went for that very dark similarities that I had with the sound, which was very creepy, although I didn't want to go for the same exact tone. I used a lot of those, like, very dissonant sounds to make it very eerie. Nice. And then I interjected track four, which is Witch's Enchantment. I wanted to go for the old school, you know, witch kind of feel. I was thinking of, like some of those 80s and 90s movies where there was, like, you know, like, witchcraft taking place in the woods, you know, where people would, you know, would be going full force into magic. And I wanted to, you know, capture that feel, like, of when the magic actually occurs, when, you know, the person practicing it becomes empowered, or, you know, becomes, you know, makes that transition from human to, you know, otherworldly in that strong sense.
Maybe a little hocus pocus type feel.
Yes, definitely. Definitely hocus pocus. Maybe that, but more like, I would say a little bit more primal, a little bit more like in your face so much, sure. Not so much Disneyfied or sanitized in a way.
Fair enough.
But I also have Approaching the Dead of Night, which is another track where I tried to go for a spooky, low-key kind of feel with like a jazzy brush drum and a piano sound that, you know, made it more like you're walking outside at night, you know, on a cobblestone road, just envisioning like, you know, a town where no one's present, but you're just seeing buildings and reflections of light hitting and, you know, just seeing random shadows appear, but you don't know if it's you or if it's someone else lurking in the distance. I also have As the Incense Burns, which is my sixth track. As the Incense Burns has like a, starts off with an Eastern feel, which has a percussive kind of darkness feel, which I wanted to engage to give it like a fusion kind of feel. So nice. It felt like almost like ethereal and ambient, but also as if you're like, you know, sleeping through the night, like, you know, and looking for, you know, some source of like power or some source of like, you know, something to feed you. Like also if you're a vampire or, you know, someone looking to, you know, gain more from, you know, your source, as if you're like the perpetrator, you know, as if you're the villain. And then finally, my last track, The Spider Web and the Shattered Mirror, I tried to make it like a kind of like that creepy place in the attic feel. Like you're walking in the attic and you just see like just old relics of ancient, you know, forgotten artifacts of the past. And you're looking at, you know, a broken mirror with like, you know, a large spider web just dwelling there, sitting, waiting for its next catch, while you see pictures of, you know, forgotten relatives or, you know, people that have gotten lost or earlier artifacts from previous generations that weren't touched in like an old treasure chest or some sort of box. And you're just there wondering why you're there, or they're like remembering bad things or events that have happened, not knowing what's going to happen next. I tried to create that sense of apprehension in that track with a, like a strong buildup toward the end.
No, I love that. And also too, is I love how you, it's so funny. Like you approach your music, you know, like a filmmaker almost. Like, you know, everything that you've described now and then in previous times, it's always come with this like, you know, this vision, you know, of things. And I could see it visually in my mind. And not a lot of musicians, you know, necessarily do that. Like, you know, you come in with it and like, you know, like this is like, this is what you visually would see while this song is playing. You approach it from a very visual medium type of deal, which is so wonderfully unique, or at least from my perspective. I've talked to a lot of musicians and they're like, well, this is how I like feel, and like, you know, this is like, you know, my experience. Like how you approach music is a story, and I think I really appreciate that. You know, being a filmmaker and an actor, like, you know, that you appreciate and you explain it in a visual sense, and it's kind of cool. It takes, you know, and I think that's what can allow a person that isn't normally, you know, a music aficionado or like a, you know, a, somebody who can really have a strong imagination. You kind of provided the visual for them, and you kind of give them a head start, and then they can be invited into this really cool little world of, you know, of yours.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to interject, you know, imagination, and I tried to vividly paint that, you know, because I cannot paint actual art because I'm a terrible drawer and I cannot sketch to save my life. So I try to create that art and channel it into music and sound, and to, you know, see if others can draw the sound and draw from that and visualize what they interpret based on that. Someone might, listening to it, might envision something different than what I appear to it, but that's the beauty of music, is that you have the ability to reinterpret it in your own way, to say, okay, maybe I disagree with the title of the song because I don't hear that when I hear it. But that's what I try to, you know, set out for. I try to look for those who might enjoy the art or enjoy the music, or those who even dislike it but may find something interesting about it. You know, there's people who are not going to like any of the material I create because it's very dissonant in many spots, and some of it's very horror based, and that's going to naturally alienate a lot of people who don't like horror. That's great. I'm trying to go for a niche, and I'm trying to go for those who, you know, might want to have a listening experience rather than just, you know, an album of pure style of music. I mean, I attract fans from many different styles, some of whom are metalheads, some of whom are, you know, classical fans, some of who like electronic music or industrial, others who just like experimental ambient noise, and others who just like horror that just want it as a novelty. You know, each of that is valid in their own right, and I enjoy the feedback I've gotten from people all across the spectrum.
No, absolutely, absolutely, man. I love that, and I think I think this is a good spot to dive right into the question of the podcast to close us out. And it was something I was bubbling, and I was actually going to ask you as a question, but I'm like, you know what? I'll save this. I'll save this for the for the question of the podcast. Why do all of us keep coming back to horror? For our creative things, like, why do we keep coming back to the well? Why is it that from a creative standpoint, all of us want to keep creating horror, you know, through our art, you know, and we seem to be attracted to people who also want to do the same thing. And I'm very curious, you know, from all of our perspectives of why we keep coming back to this genre.
Horror doesn't leave us. It doesn't leave you. It stays with you. Comedy comes and goes. Comedy either fades or transcends from either acceptable or not acceptable. Drama gets old after a while. It just reminds you of real life. Action movies, we love action, but they're far-fetched. I mean, how many people do you see hanging out of a car, shooting a gun at somebody while making a backflip off of a railway onto the ground, as in a movie such as Taken? Or, vigilante movies, you know, as fun as some of them are, like Death Wish or, you know, others that have that similar ability, they might be good for a rush, but again, far-fetched. You know, they kind of detach you from reality, but don't really give you that satisfaction as much as horror does. Horror taps into fear of the unknown. You know, the fear of the unknown can be something psychological. It could be something, you know, like visual. It could be something that you have in your mind. It could be something that, you know, allows you to step out of the bounds of reality into fantasy. And it doesn't matter what your background is or what one's beliefs are or what one's principles are. Horror can hit you at any point, and different things can trigger each button of an individual into a different way that manifests, you know, anxiety, dread, or just complete old-fashioned fear in a way that makes you want to crawl under a rock. And each human animal has a different thing that they're very afraid of. That's why, for example, you know, to divert a bit, Pennywise the clown from It or Freddy Krueger, they manifest into what each person fears the most, and they shapeshift as they go along, you know, tailoring their horror to each person that they want to, you know, exploit or, you know, snuff out for their own gain or for their own satisfaction. You know, and I think many of us horror creators know that. So, you know, for myself, I know that, you know, I've gone through my whole life with apprehensions, dreads, fears, and things that I'm always paranoid about. And I feel like the best way to cathartically purge that is through horror. I've not gotten that same satisfaction with other styles of music or with other styles of entertainment that I've indulged myself in. So I decided to go all in and just let out my pure emotion and go back to it. And I feel like that's been what's connected most with listeners in a way. That's allowed me to get the most feedback, get the most, you know, personal connection from the artist to the consumer or listener or the person engaging with and with which I work with or associate with, which is why I've pretty much made horror my favorite and most passionate genre to put most of my everyday energy and time into. I mean, if that's pretty much it. I mean, I could expand more on it, but I feel like that's pretty much the point that I've driven home.
Nice. In a nutshell. Zach.
I'm a fucked up person who likes fucked up things. It's really that simple for me. I like dark, vile, bloody, disturbing things, and I'm sure there's something mentally wired wrong in my head, but I don't care. I keep it contained. It's fine. I just like dark, vile things, and horror gives me that plentiful.
Yes, it
fantastic.
Does. Yes, it does.
That that's it is. And you're allowed to control yourself in that environment and, yep. you know, fantasize about, you know, idiots getting their heads chopped off by some, you know, masked killer or people who just are complete trash and low life, just getting exactly what they deserve. You know, it's just like just watching people who have to be completely snarky assholes. You think about them in real life and then you watch a movie and then you imagine that person you can't stand, that person that cuts you off from traffic or that person that cursed you out, you know, in the supermarket. And you're thinking, yeah, what if you were met with Terrifier or with Jason Voorhees or with Art the Clown or with Pennywise. Let's imagine what happens to you if you try to pull that shit with them.
I fucking love that. And that's the reason why that all the horror fans are all you know, really well adjusted, to be perfectly honest, is because they get that Absolutely. Shit out. They get those emotions out. And I think I'll close out with mine. You know, I think at the end of the day, horror's fucking fun. It's a fun genre. It doesn't always take itself so seriously all the time. It's not this, you know, it can be, you know, and some people do, but like, I think the way we do it is it's always fun. There's the, you know, I think I like comedy and horror for the same reasons. They have the same beats, but like, to me, it never loses its fun. Like it's a fun thing. Yeah. And also too is, you know, I remember the line from Batman Begins and he said, people need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy. And I love it. It's all there, but there's some good horror beats even in that movie, which is interesting, but I think that whole like doc scene, I'm like that's a horror beat, that's a horror scene, like, you know, the only thing you're not doing is killing people, but like they like you know, because I know you're Batman and that's how it works, but like literally everything that you're doing in this is like him, like the guy screwed, like where are you, and then like right behind him, here, and then like does that, I'm like that's like what, like all you're missing is a hot, you know, like. Like, yeah, I get it. You're wearing hockey pads versus a hockey mask, but shit, you're basically doing the same fucking thing. But anyway, but more importantly is you can make, it's appropriate to be very heavy handed with your, with your metaphors and your points in horror. Like you can really get to the root of some very important things that you want to say in a very loud fashion. And it's acceptable. It's acceptable to have this, you know, to have this, because it's a very forceful and aggressive and loud and energy filled genre. You know, in the same way that people love metal. Can get your fucking, you know, shit across. Hey, dickhead, I'm trying to say X. Reanimator. Hey, dickhead. It's not a good fucking idea to bring people back from the dead once they're dead. Or Pet Sematary. Hey, dickhead, your kid is dead. I'm sorry, that sucks a lot. But the kid that you're gonna bring back from the grave is not gonna be the kid that you left. Like it's just not. He's gonna stab people in the fucking Achilles tendon.
It's pretty much like, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
Yep. Shit, exactly. But that's, I think, it's a really cool way to shake it up and really say something in a very powerful way, and it's acceptable. It's an acceptable way to do it. You can't quite do it the way that you do it in horror. So, sir, this is your opportunity to look directly into the camera and tell the good people where they can find you on all your social medias and all that great stuff. And it's your plug and your floor.
All right. Well, you could first, you know, head to my official website, cucurbitophobia.com, or you could find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and even TikTok. I don't use TikTok very much, but I do have a page up there if you want to add me on. I would say you could also find all of my albums, you know, on all digital streaming services. I do have a Bandcamp page where you could find all of my albums, including some releases that are not on digital streaming services. So if you go to my Bandcamp, you're supporting me directly and possibly engaging in more musical content than you would on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, etc. Or I do have physical CDs of my albums, where if you visit my website, you can order them directly for me. I also have some vinyls on demand, which I will, you know, also be reissuing some of them later on in this year. So please keep back and keep checking back to my website for more updates, and join my mailing list, cucurbitophobia@gmail.com. And where I can send you updates and, you know, sometimes send you a couple of free perks, you know, discounts that are not privy to the public, and potential merchandise that I will be exclusively releasing to, you know, close friends and fans and those who I engage with, you know, on an occasional basis. But also, I also wanted to thank you very, very much, Mark and Zach, for having me on the show. And it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate the support and the camaraderie that we've built up over the years. And I, you guys are awesome,
dude.
We're glad you're willing to come on,
dude. Absolutely, bro. It's always great hanging out with you, man. So, and then hey, everybody, please go and check out Rob's stuff. He is absolutely fantastic. I've listened to his music many times. Obviously, we've had him compose for us. He was on his music was actually on an episode of Horror Fact of the Day. It was a kick-ass Carol the Bells remix. It was fucking fantastic. So please support your local artists the way that you would support celebrities. He's awesome. Go check out his stuff. And if you can, support him on Bandcamp. He's fucking fantastic. So I will close out this podcast. Thank you so much for checking out this episode of the Nightmares Podcast. You can find us as well, where all podcasts can be found on Spotify, Anchor, iTunes, and all those other great places. And if you are watching us on YouTube, you can go ahead and stab that like button, smash that subscribe, and click that little dingy bell to be notified every time we drop amazing content right here on MHN. And of course, you can check us out on all of our social medias, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, and
Slasher.
That is the application for all things horror. Thank you so much, and we'll check you next time on the Nightmares Podcast. Bye, guys.